Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. With its soaring azure sky and stark landscapes, the American Southwest is one of the most hauntingly beautiful regions of the world. Yet staggering population growth combined with the intensifying effects of climate change is driving the oasis-based society close to the brink of a Dust Bowl-scale catastrophe. This morning we talk with William DeBuys, author of A Great Aridness, about what the Southwest might look like when the heat turns up and the water runs out. We'll look at how the semi-arid land, vulnerable to water shortages, rising temperatures, wildfires, and a host of other environmental challenges, is poised to bear the heaviest consequences of global climate chaos. Bill, welcome back to Locus Focus.
It's great to be with you, Barbara.
Well, before we start talking about the Southwest, I just wanted to hear about the climate march. Did you actually get back to D.C. for the march?
I was there, yeah. It was quite a day. It was a beautiful day, a bit on the hot side, which had some poetic justice to it. All-time high was set for April 29th for Washington, D.C. I think it hit, the mercury hit 92 degrees, and there was a very good turnout for the march. I think I haven't seen any real estimate of crowd size. My guess is that it was at least 100,000 and maybe twice that.
Actually, I heard reports that it was 200,000. I think that's what 350.org was claiming.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, that fits. That sounds right.
Because we had one here. Yeah.
As marches often do, it had a kind of festival air. The atmosphere among the crowd was really generous and friendly. The cops who were, directing things and providing security were all pretty wonderful and good-hearted, and people were thanking them. It was an event of genuine solidarity.
Well, I'm thinking how this actually has become an annual event. There's been a climate march in the spring for several years now, I think. I'm wondering if you've been at any of the other ones. They're all in New York or Washington, D.C., and this is the first year I recall that they've been in cities all around the country, as are all the marches these days. But I'm wondering if you thought there was something special about this march compared to the previous ones.
Well, I think what was really special about it was that it came only a week after the Science March, and only a month and some weeks after the Women's March. The pressure, and this is key, this is really key, I think, is to keep the pressure up. I hope there is some kind of significant demonstration virtually every Saturday that Congress is in session in Washington, D.C.
No, actually, my sense at the march here in Portland last week is that there's been a little bit of burnout. It was like the third march I'd gone to in 3 weeks, and the same was true for a lot of people. But there were actually fewer people, I think, at the climate march in Portland last week than there had been at the March for Science. So I'm wondering, what's your thought about how do we keep the energy up without burning people out?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure I have an answer to that. But I think one of the ways to do it is to try to have fun with these things. Keep avoiding burnout is important, because even more important is keeping up the pressure and keeping up our mutual support for each other as we work on these issues. I'm as pessimistic as anyone, and at the climate march in Washington, I had the good fortune of doing it with my two kids, who are 35 and 31. And I expressed I said, well, this is probably futile. And my daughter, who's 35, said quickly, no, Dad, it may not make much impression on the occupant of the White House, but the people in Congress are going to be aware of this, and they're going to be thinking about 2018. And my son, later, he's the 31-year-old, he said a second important reason that this march is so vital is that it energizes all of us. It keeps us supporting each other. It keeps us participating in a way that maybe we wouldn't do. And it's very important to keep our whole community pumped up all the way to November of 2018 and beyond.
One of the revelations I've had in the last few weeks is realizing the importance of making sure we stay on track with the work that we were doing before Trump was elected president, because a lot of us, I think, got very derailed and kind of emotionally stultified for weeks or months. But a lot of us have been doing very important work related to climate or related to many other issues, and that if we can find ways to incorporate the new reality that's coloring the work that we're doing, but make sure we stay on task with that work. It seems like that is like really vital, and that we aren't thrown and just completely thrown into this like panic mode. And that's one reason why I wanted to talk with you today about a book you wrote in 2011, which I think still has great relevance. And I started reading it a few months ago and thought this would be really a wonderful opportunity to talk to you again after. So anyway, so we're going to talk about A Great Aridness, which you wrote in 2011 about the Southwest. And I kind of wanted to start out by looking at how do you see this book now and what you were saying back, what's it, like 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, in relationship to how things are unfolding now. And I want to look at two markers. One is the Paris Climate Agreement, which was a big surprise, I think, for a lot of us, and then what's been happening, or what feels like it's happening since Trump was elected.
Well, looking back at the book, you know, it appeared in 2011. Most of the research was done from mid-2008 through 2010. And looking back, I'm very proud of the book, and I don't think that any of the modeling that's reported in the book, any of the predictions, any of the data presented, has been contradicted by events. In fact, I think what we've learned over the intervening time is that those models are very robust, and that things are moving along in the direction they forecast, and if anything, the one thing that they miss is the speed with which the changes are taking place. Some of these changes appear to be taking place faster than the models predicted.
Which seems to be, that seems to have been the story for the last 15 years, actually. I think that we keep hearing that.
Yeah, and not just with regard to the Southwest, but with regard to climate change in general.
Well, I found it interesting to read a book about climate change focusing on the Southwest, because mostly we hear about we hear about Antarctica, and we hear about the Arctic, and particularly Greenland and Alaska, and how rapidly the influence of climate change is really changing the landscape and the ecology and perhaps the rest of the world as a result. Why is it so critical to also look at the Southwest and to see what's happening there? And maybe how is that analogous to some other arid regions in the world?
Well, first, it does make sense that we would be hearing a lot about the poles, about the highest latitudes, because according to the models, the changes should take place fastest and most emphatically there at the poles in the very high latitudes. The reason why we should keep an eye on the Southwest after that is that the Southwest going into this period of rapid change was already under such stress. Our water resources are essentially fully promised and over-allocated, and our ecological systems in many respects are subject to very or vulnerable to very small fluctuations of temperature and heat that can produce very big, very big changes. And for that reason, we've been seeing these enormous forest fires in the Southwest that are really resulting in type changes. What happens when we get these very big hot burns in the Southwest is we get a landscape that isn't going to come back as forest again. We're seeing conversions of forest to desert shrub. We're seeing, you know, and to other shrubs, clonal shrubs, and we're seeing new ecologies emerge that we haven't had before.
Well, you have actually an interesting opening in your introduction where you talk about three themes that I guess really run through the book. And I kind of wanted to run these by you and look at how this shapes the way we'll talk about this for the rest of the hour. The first one is no big thing happens for just one reason. The second one is the human contribution to change in the natural world is more often catalyzes than dictates the outcome. And finally, that human beings have an enormous capacity to adapt. So let's take each one at a time. What do you mean by no big thing happens for one reason? And how does that affect the way that we view what's happening around climate change, and particularly in the Southwest?
Well, no big thing happens for just one reason is intended to evoke awareness of the complexity of the world as it actually operates. And so we can think about rising temperatures as one variable shifting, but it interacts with many other variables, and especially with the human dimension We always, every place has a history. Every place has changing trends of change already underway that then climate change interacts with. And so as we see, for instance, water shortages develop in the Southwest, in a sense, even if water supplies decline, we don't have a shortage of water. We have a longage of people. If there weren't so many people depending on the water, having lowered supplies wouldn't be that big a problem. That was the case in the very severe drought of the 1950s when water supplies dropped a lot. But it wasn't the great problem for cities and for irrigated agriculture that it is today. It was a great problem for unirrigated agriculture and for ranching, but it wasn't so great a problem for developed areas. Now we have these developed areas with huge populations, and so any decline in water quantity, water supply, ramifies onward in many, many ways.
Well, there also seems to be a pattern in the Southwest of civilizations building up, thriving, and then seeming to disappear. And I wanted to talk a little bit about a couple of the civilizations in the Southwest that you talk about in your book, in Chaco Canyon, and of course, Mesa Verde is another very famous one. And then you mentioned Sand Canyon. And compare that with what are the lessons to be learned from those disappearances of civilizations? And what do you think, do you think that those civilizations were also affected by climate change?
Well, there's no question but that those civilizations were heavily affected by extended droughts, what we call mega droughts, droughts that last a decade or several decades. And the ultimate decline of Chaco, the ultimate decline of the Mesa Verdean civilization, which included San Canyon Pueblo, which I write about in some detail, those places were all influenced very heavily by drought in their final decline. And one thing to take note of with regard to Mesa Verde, which includes much more than just the area of Mesa Verde where the national park is, it included really all of southwest Colorado, extending into Utah and southward into northern New Mexico. In that area, the evidence is that those communities also declined because of violence. And the violence was probably, almost certainly, brought on by drought, which put enormous pressure on communities around the fringe that maybe didn't have as blessed an environment. And it put people in motion. It created climate refugees who then went to where the water was and fought with the people who were there, and the rising tide of violence was part of what undermined the whole civilization. We make droughts worse when there's violence. It's harder to tend a field. It's harder to bring in a crop. Apart from the violence, maybe the Mesa Verde and Pueblos could have survived the drought, at least in some numbers. But it was so bad that in the end, pretty much everybody pulled up stakes and left.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with William DeBuys, who is the author of A Great Aridness, amongst many other books. And we talked to him a couple months ago about this Sala, a mythological creature that he chased after in Laos a number of years ago. And there may be some relationship actually between the story of the Sala, I think, and the story of the Southwest in terms of disappearing resources. But what you're just saying about the violence intersecting with drought and how that's a real fatal combination makes me think of two things. It makes me think of the extreme case being what's going on in Syria right now. It also makes me think of a number of people that I've run into in Portland who have moved up here from the Southwest because they're saying it's too hot. And there is certainly undercurrents and rumblings in the Northwest about concern about all these people from the Southwest moving up here and ruining our communities. So let's look, first of all, at Syria, which is a very violent example of what you're describing, and then see how this might play out here in the United States as well.
Yeah, it's an underappreciated fact that there is a climate component to the civil war in Syria, that Syria is suffering from a prolonged drought and some of the worsening of the ethnic conflict in Syria leading up to the outbreak of hostilities was driven to some degree by competition over water. So it's an underlying force there. It's an underlying force in the instability in South Sudan and in other portions of the Sahel right now. I think there are 25 million refugees in the world today. Some reports predict that with climate change, that number will move up toward 150 million refugees by the middle of this century. So just think about that number of people in motion, desperate for a way to hang on, to survive, to take care of their families. And you have a recipe for increasing political instability and violence. And this is the reason that, notwithstanding the deniers like Trump and Pruitt and all those other wretched human beings, the U.S. military and the CIA have identified climate change as a national security issue for decades now.
Well, I think it's kind of ironic, actually, that on the one hand, Trump is denying climate change and doing, I just was reading today about more rollbacks of taking more data off of the EPA website, that now they've dismantled the part of the website about climate change that was aimed at students and children. And he's fired like at least half or more of the science advisors, probably all who would be advising about the importance of talking about climate change and working to mitigate it. So that's the one hand on Trump. On the other hand is he's doing everything he can to stop refugees from coming up from Latin America by building the wall. And these refugees are being, their need to move is triggered by climate change. So how do we reconcile those two conflicts and how do we call him out on what's going on?
Well, I think he's being called out again and again and again. He is so comfortable in his own ignorance that being called out is not a negative for him. And so I don't know how you turn those people around other than by somehow persuading people they respect. And this is where I think somehow the popular movement has to enlist more and more of the business community. The business, and as much as you may dislike corporate influence and so forth, the corporate powers are perhaps the only powers that Trump and his like will listen to. And so the more big companies that come around to speaking out, and there have been some, the more big ones, the better. because maybe Trump and Pruitt and their like will actually begin listening to someone outside their own little bubble of interest, of ignorance. One of the signs I liked best from the climate march on the 29th of April was one that said, "Trump and Pruitt, go fact yourselves."
Well, you have two themes that, or there were two metaphors in your book that I found really fascinating, as far as like following the story about climate change in the Southwest and also looking at how we deal with it. And the first one was talking about how you tracking, and you start the book out by talking about this murder mystery that was solved by somebody who was a really good tracker. And so the same thing is true with tracking the mystery of how our climate's changing and what's causing it to change. The other one that I found even more inspiring was lava falls, the major falls in the Grand Canyon. That's, I guess, every rafter's dream or nightmare to to float. And the planning you need to take when you're in that flat water just about to go over the precipice. So let's first talk about tracking, and then we can talk about rafting.
Yeah. Well, I like that metaphor, too. It came to me one day that the work of those Navajo trackers who had to pick out the tracks of the perpetrators, the arsonists and murderers who killed a trader and burned down his trading post, they had to pick those tracks out of an area that people and their animals had trampled for more than 24 hours before the trackers really got to their work. And that's so much like studying climate. There's so much data. There's so much information out there, and there's noise mixed with the data, a lot of random facts. And somehow, with all this universe of information, you have to pick out the signal. You've got to pick out the pattern that really tells a story. You got to find the tracks that were made by the murderers and arsonists. And so it's really that sorting signal from noise was the problem that the trackers faced, and it's the same problem that climate modelers face. And really smart people, be they Navajo trackers or scientists today, show us that even in these enormously complex problems, we can figure out what the thread is. We can decipher the story.
So what is that thread?
Well, in the thread of the trackers, it was finding the path of the guys who had done the crime. And in climate change, it's finding the pattern of how big systems are changing. And we have very, very good information on that now. I mean, the deniers will say that the science is equivocal and the jury is still out, but that's absolutely not the case. The science is not equivocal, and the jury's not out. To go back to the climate march, another sign in the march said, 3% of scientists say this march isn't happening. I thought that was a pretty good one. And so we have really remarkable consensus of the scientific community on what's happening and on the direction of change and on the likely consequences of that change. So we need to get busy with action.
So then let's get back to that flat water that we're floating on just before we go over the falls. What is the analogy there in terms of what we're facing? And particularly, I want to start focusing again on the Southwest, which for a lot of listeners here in the Northwest, the idea of having water scarcity, especially after the winter we've just had, is kind of unimaginable. But I think that it's really important that people, even in wet climates, appreciate what's going on in the Southwest and how that can be an analog for what we may be experiencing all over the world after a while. So what happens as you're poised to go over the precipice? What do you have to do?
Well, the river runners in your audience will know that as you approach a rapid, you control only a couple of things. You can control your angle, your point of entry, and your velocity. And so those three things are really important. But once you're committed into the water, once the current takes you over, well, your ability to alter your variables diminishes in proportion to the, you know, violence of the water. And that means it's so critical to get that point of entry and your angle and velocity just right, so that you can maximize your chances of handling all the stuff that's going to pop up as you go down through the rapids. And so that, in the book, that's what I argue, that as we enter the rapids of climate change, and we're pretty well into them now, we need to pay a lot of attention about the few things that we can control. Because as time goes on, the current's going to dictate more to us, and we'll have less and less control of outcomes.
Well, actually, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio, and we're talking this morning with Bill DeBuise, who's author of A Great Aridness, that's about the dire impacts of climate change on the Southwest and how it really even relates to us here in the wet Northwest. What are some of the ways that people are, like, as we are still floating in the flat water, what are some of the options that are being floated to deal with this precipice that we're facing, and particularly that you're facing there in the southwestern part of North America?
Well, I'm not sure that they're being dealt with all that well, but I can tell you a few things that I think we ought to be working on, and that is, for instance, we're going to see in the Southwest, as the screws of drought tighten down on us, we're going to see the reallocation of a lot of water from agriculture to urban and industrial uses. The Southwest actually has a lot of water. Most of it's used in agriculture. And so as the shortages increase, some of that ag water is going to go to the use of cities. And so what we ought to be doing now is preparing the mechanisms for those kinds of reallocations, including the social policies and economic policies to soften the economic blow on the agricultural communities that are going to have less agriculture going on. Now, that includes, you know, the water rights holders, the owners of land, will do fine. You know, they'll be paid handsomely by the cities for the use of their water. But it's the pickers, the truck drivers, the schools that depend on agricultural economic activity for the taxes that keep their doors open. It's the implement salesmen and the seed salesmen and all the rest of the agricultural community are going to need some help as reorganization takes place. So that would be one thing. And to make these transfers happen efficiently, we should be setting up the framework for the legal transfers, all the environmental review and things like that in advance, so that we don't get bogged down in lawsuits and procedures when we really need to see the water move from one use to another. So that's just one example of the kinds of things we could be working on.
Well, I'm thinking back to when we talked originally, which was back in 2002, when I was doing a project about the Colorado and Columbia Rivers, kind of comparing them and contrasting them. And at that time, this big agreement between the Imperial Valley Irrigation District and the cities of San Diego and L.A. was in the works. They were talking about it, and there was a lot of trepidation about it. I guess a year after I finished the documentary, it actually was signed and and it's gone into force since then. But I was wondering, in reading your book, and I'm currently reading another book about the Colorado River Basin, it sounds like a whole lot really hasn't changed since 2002 in terms of people's attitudes. And I'm wondering, you're a lot closer to it than I am, what's your sense? Are people really accepting this major change that irrigation districts are not going to get the water they've been accustomed to having for over 100 years? Or is there a change of mindset now where people are recognizing that they have to really change the way they think and the way they operate if they're going to survive?
Well, I think there's the hint of a change of mindset when drought is really palpable. But dry years are always interspersed with wetter years. And as soon as the water becomes relatively abundant again, people stop focusing on getting ready for the hard times. And I call this the hydro-illogic cycle, and not the hydrologic cycle, but the hydro-illogic cycle, because people forget the pain of drought as soon as the rains come. So we've got a long way to go still. And the fact that as a nation we are not officially, our government is not accepting the plain face of climate change, the plain facts of it, retards the kind of proactive adaptations that we could be making now.
Well, I think about Governor Jerry Brown in California, who seemed to be a little late in the game of actually mandating water efficiencies and conservation and restrictions during like the last year of the horrific drought that the Southwest was going through. And then this year, where I don't think that the Southwest had as much water as we had here in the Northwest, but a lot of water. And I heard a few months ago that Jerry Brown was easing up on a lot of those restrictions. It seems to me it's kind of like you've been poor all your life, you make a lot of money all of a sudden, and instead of saving it, you just start to spend it.
Yeah, well, that's the normal pattern, alas. And as much as Jerry Brown might merit criticism, he's light years ahead of the leaders of Utah, Arizona, New Mexico. I won't say Colorado because they've got a pretty good water program there in Colorado, and that could be a model for those other states I just mentioned.
Well, as we're talking, I'm thinking this topic could probably spill into another program, which maybe we should schedule. I feel like this is such a big issue, and it's really important for people around the country to appreciate what's going on in the Colorado Basin, because it really reflects on some of our problems elsewhere. And maybe there's analogies that can be made, as you were saying earlier, about how much the desert has been built up and both populated in cities and also much more intensive agriculture in the last 50, 60 years. The same thing's true about coastal communities, which are also really endangered by climate change. And 50 years ago, there wasn't nearly the kind of money invested in coastal America and probably rest of coastal the coastal globe as there is now. So I'm thinking that this is something that even though a lot of people in the Northwest don't spend a lot of time thinking about the Colorado River, maybe they should. But I want to, in the remaining time that we have, talk a little bit about some of the solutions that are being floated. And one of them that I found, let's say the most graphic, is Pat Mulroy, who's somebody I talked to again back in 2002. And why don't we talk a little bit about who she is, and I guess she's retired now since you finished your book, but what she brought to the whole water debate in the Southwest and how that flies now.
Well, Pat Mulroy was, first of all, a magnetic and powerful personality. She had many friends. She had many enemies as well. But she was probably the least conventional thinker among the people who wielded real power on water in the Colorado River Basin. And it's interesting that she should come from Las Vegas, New Mexico, basically, the water authority there, Las Vegas, Nevada, I'm sorry.
Slightly different place.
We have a Las Vegas in New Mexico, which I have to point out and distinguish from Las Vegas, Nevada all the time. But Pat came out of a water culture that wasn't rooted in the deep past of the Southwest, which is all about irrigated agriculture and ranching. And so she came to the table with a fresher point of view than her other colleagues in the Colorado River Water Dialogue. And with her force of personality and creativity, she created a lot more ferment, or took advantage of the ferment that was there, and also empowered other people who were thinking outside the box. She also initiated a terrific water grab to get more water for Greater Las Vegas from ranch lands in eastern Nevada and western Utah. And that's another story that she may be remembered for as well. But in many respects, she had a positive influence on things and shaking things up and getting the water community to think much more freely and openly and creatively about ways to maximize water resources.
Well, when I talked to her, one of the big things she promoted was the water banking notion, which I think was rather innovative when she first started doing that.
Yeah, that's
you might explain to listeners here what that is, actually.
Well, for instance, Nevada has done a deal with Arizona under which Arizona has diverted some of Nevada's water and injected it into depleted aquifers to store for a future date for Nevada's use. And the water wouldn't be pumped back upstream to Nevada, but rather Nevada would do an exchange when Nevada needs the water. Nevada would do an exchange with Arizona and take some of Arizona's surface water out of Lake Mead, and Arizona would be free then to use the Nevada water stored in its aquifer. If you follow all that, it's a little bit complicated, but that's the kind of thing that Pat Mulroy broke ground to make possible in the Colorado Basin.
Well, as you're talking, I realize we probably should have grounded this conversation with the basics of Western water law. So in the last few moments, let's talk a little bit about that, and then I think this sets the stage for doing part two of this show in a few weeks where we can actually...
All right.
Because I really want to get into talking about the differences in the approaches that the different Southwest states are taking towards dealing with an incredible water shortage, and just even mentioning how what it means that the Colorado River is overallocated. So let's just end the show by talking about Western water law and what we have to deal with now.
Well, Western water law is based fundamentally on the doctrine of prior appropriation, which is to say that the first party that puts water to use develops a water right that is senior to all subsequent efforts to put use on that river. And in theory, the oldest water right trumps all the younger water rights. So that as water becomes more scarce, you eliminate the younger water rights and continue to honor the oldest ones progressively. And that has some really interesting implications because, for instance, on the Colorado, in order to get congressional approval for the Central Arizona Project, which delivers Colorado River water uphill to Phoenix and Tucson and lots of other communities along the line of the aqueducts that the CAP built, in order to get that congressional approval to build that gigantic project, Arizona's political delegation had to agree to subordinate its Colorado River water rights to those of California's. And what that means is that when there are shortages on the lower Colorado, Arizona will have to absorb its pro rata share of shortages, but it will also have to absorb California's pro rata share of shortages, because its rights are now junior on the Colorado to to those of California. This is a lot of people would say this is an unfairness. A lot of other people would say that the CAP should never have been built and that it was sort of the final nail in the coffin of the Colorado that assured the overuse of the river and the desiccation of its delta.
Well, on that note,
wherever you line up, what it leaves us with is that people may be washing their cars liberally one day in Santa Monica, and the taps will be effectively running dry on Colorado River water in Phoenix and Tucson.
Well, on that note, I think we're going to put this talk on hold and see if we can check in again maybe at the end of June and continue the conversation.
That'd be fine with me.
And I just want to let you know I'm going to be doing a show about the Great Lakes in the third week in June. And since the Great Lakes is one of the places that water brokers in the Southwest have thought about diverting water from, it might be interesting to do a follow-up after the Great Lakes show on the Colorado River Basin and see how those two regions kind of interact with each other or shouldn't interact with each other.
Yeah, that opens some interesting questions.
So we'll talk about that in June. Anyway, it's really great talking with you, Bill, and I'm looking forward to talking with you again.
Okay, thank you so much, Barbara. Great to talk with you.
We've been talking with William DeBuise, who is author of A Great Aridness, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Michael Carroll, and who's author of No One Eats Alone. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Natalie Merchant. Next week is a pledge drive, so stay tuned. Thanks for listening.